Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Exchange. My name is Paul, and I'm delighted again to be able to speak to professional investor John Heumann of Vox Markets. So, welcome, John.
Hello, Paul. How are you doing?
Yeah, it's great being live, isn't it, with our new video as well. But before we sort of like go through all that, we've had a ton of geopolitical, macro and corporate news over the past few weeks. But before we sort of say dig into the markets and stuff, I don't suppose you could quickly remind the audience of what type of investor you are, what kind of stocks you like.
Yeah, well, not actually a professional one. I mean, I used to be an analyst many years ago. I had my CE qualifications, the old SFA, registered rep, which then became the FSA and then the FCA. So you can see how long ago that was. I only invest for my own benefit. And, what I do, though, is study the markets and study companies and, you know, proffer my opinions of them, which is not advice. You know, I spent 10 years as the editor of Investors Chronicle. And, you know, what we were trying to do all the time there was teach people how to be better investors, how to be self-directed, how to basically take control of their own financial decision making. So no advice is given by me. I am a sort of value stroke growth investor. You know, I like things to be cheap when I buy them for the first time, because a lot of future returns come from your starting point, your starting valuation. But I don't want companies that are sort of basically X growth at the same time. And I think at the moment you can buy some good growth companies at sort of value pricing. It's quite a market. It's been quite a market, and hopefully it's changing.
And how's your investment sort of track record sort of performed over the past few years, and also in particular sort of year to date? The market seems to have been pretty lively, actually. I was just running the numbers, and I think it's up sort of like 7 or 8% in the all share this year so far. I'm unfortunately in the red big time, but I have a lot of idiosyncrasies. How are you getting on?
Not too bad. I mean, it's fairly flattish. It's been good the last, you know, month or so. There's been a notable recovery in a lot of my holdings. I've had some really strong contributors this year. Poolbeg, most recently, has really taken off. Since they announced some very decent results, you know, since they secured their patent over in the US for the use of their lead asset, POLB001, as a companion therapy for immunotherapies for cancer treatment. Huge, huge potential there. HVivo has been doing really well. Yeah, some of the big companies have been doing really well. So Unilever, really, really strong contributor. And I think, you know, that's where the all shares performance has been driven this year by the, you know, the FTSE 100. Really hitting record levels, and the small cap is still, you know, small cap end of the market still struggling a little bit, and you can see that in my portfolio. Kind of smaller companies are recovering a bit, but they haven't really sort of got out the blocks massively yet.
And when do you think the small caps will recover, John, in terms of, because obviously had the Bank of England yesterday reiterating it's going to hold interest rates for the moment, but it was sort of implying that inflation was coming down and going to meet its target in 2 years of 2%. It saw product inflation also coming below 2% fairly quickly. When do you think that sort of interest rate is going to come down, and is it going to boost small cap valuations, multiples?
$1 million question, isn't it? But you know, I've seen some people saying now, you know, sort of June, July, but who knows? I mean, you know, all the speculation about rate cuts, whether it's over here or over in the US, has been wide of the mark so far. You know, and the market has sort of got off to false start several times, only to be sort of set back again when we've had some more sort of hawkish statements from various central bankers. So yeah, who knows? I mean, when it does happen, it will naturally boost, you know, growth assets, because a lot of their value is in the future, and obviously a lower interest rate means a lower discount rate. So those profits at present value are worth more, you know, it's sort of accounting effects of it. So you would expect lower rates to have an effect.
Well, that would be great.
And I don't think it's been fully priced in yet.
No, I would agree. Yeah, that'd be great news. If it's a matter of when, just being patient and waiting, then that's fab. Now, can you just give us an update on the new sort of investment service that Vox is doing, which is the Growth Capital Investor?
Growth Company.
Yeah, Growth Company. That's it, yeah.
Growth Company Investor, yeah. So we've taken that over. It was one of the very few magazines that really covered UK small caps in any great detail. And sadly, it had to close last year, but we're resurrecting that brand. The editor at the time, David Thornton, editor and owner, in fact, is back writing. So we are busy scribbling away in the background, producing the first reports for that. Should be going live in a couple of weeks.
Wow, good. Excellent. Well, we'll look forward to reading those. I've got anybody wants to ask questions, please jot them, put them into the chat box. We got one from Lemmy Physical, who I think is a long-term fan of Taking Stock. And he's asking about, when's that program coming back, John? I don't know whether you've got
no plans to bring it back. No plans to bring it back just yet.
Okay, right, fine. Okay, that's easy enough. Now, we've also got one from, it was overnight actually, from a guy called Alan Spratt on Twitter or X. And he's talking about XP Factory. And I think you've interviewed the management team here. And he basically says, obviously, the performance of the business is doing very well. We've had battle bars up about 11% like for like. We've had Escape Hunt up about 12% like for like,
yeah.
But the shares have sort of like been a bit soggy. And the key question is, when is it going to turn? I guess it sort of comes back to that $1 million question.
Yeah. I mean, so there was a trading update for 13 weeks, the 31st of March, last week, I think, in fact. Trading in line with expectations. Really, I agree. It's a very interesting company. I did speak to the chief exec, Richard Harpham, who is a very, very impressive guy, knows exactly what he's doing, has spotted this gap in the market for experiential leisure in this sort of large format form, a big company doing this sort of thing. Really, really strong growth, as you say. I'm not sure what's holding the shares back. I guess, there are worries that to roll this out further is going to be expensive. There's a serious amount of capex involved in this, but as I say, I think that's really been taken into account, by management, and looking at the valuation, it's sort of overly cautious. It is a very strange one.
I mean, the thing is for investors is the like for like growth is still very strong. It's still double digits in what has been actually quite a difficult or challenging environment for leisure in the UK. So that says to me that it's winning market share, it's resonating with its customers. And if it continue on that theme, then you will see that EBITDA drop through on its existing estate. And it could probably generate a ton of cash already if it just slowed up its growth. But because it doesn't want to do that, that'd be suboptimal.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, there's a bit of debt on the balance sheet, so I guess people keep their eye on that. And anything that holds debt in the current interest rate environment is facing a sort of more of a challenging financial position than they had previously. The shares aren't necessarily cheap you know, on sort of current earnings and sort of near term earnings, but they get cheap after that. So, you know, what are we looking at forecast wise? You know, we are looking at, you know, really, really quite significant growth coming through in 2025 that takes the valuation right down. Really, really significant. As you say, that revenue starts dropping through.
Yeah,
into the profit line quite substantially. So, yeah, and the sort of borrowing line slows, and you know it starts to be able to fund more out of the cash flows. So yeah, I think you know it will turn. I think people are going to be waiting for evidence that drop through as you put it is happening.
Mm. Yeah, I think you know in terms of valuation, I did see a note which came out this week from Singers, and I think their price target's 32p in terms of valuation. So it's sort of you know you can see 100% upside, or they believe it's worth 100% upside. Okay, well let's turn to another sector on the consumer, another stock. We've got loungers, which does sort of like all day cafes and restaurants and stuff like this one. Again, the format seems to be doing very well in a difficult environment. It's up sort of like 7.5% like for like. I don't suppose you could quickly run us through what sort of piqued your interest here.
Well, I just like the company. I mean, I like the experience. I think, you know, I've always said this. I mean, it's, you know, another way that I do go about investing is, kick, you know, I like to be able to kick the tires of the companies that I'm investing in. And, you know, I've visited loungers establishments, and I think their format is absolutely fantastic. So kind of, you know, it was only after I'd actually been in one I realized it was a listed company. So I think it's been sort of flowing, you know, trading a little bit below the radar.
What's the USP then, John? Well, it's like if you went into Starbucks, what would be the difference between a sort of Starbucks or a, I don't know, you know, another type of cafe compared to loungers?
It's a dining experience, you know. So it's got various formats. It's got the core loungers format, and it's got something called Cozy Club, which is a little bit more sort of you know, cocktail-y in evenings. But it sort of caters for a broad spectrum, and it's just really well done. You know, it's got great menus, lots and lots of choice. You know, the guys that run it absolutely know what they're doing. And you know, that I would say is the same is true of XP Factory. You know, one thing that Richard Harbin told me was the amount of data that they generate in this business, you know, feeds back into improving the proposition. So, you know, they're looking at things on a really, you know, line by line basis, the minutia of what is happening to keep improving their offer at XP Factory. And they do exactly the same thing at loungers. You know, again, you know, not necessarily cheap on a headline basis. You've got that it's a capex, it's a rollout story. So there is that, again, that worry about, you know, capex and how much it's going to be spending. it reports its net debt in two ways. One is the sort of non-property net debt, but it needs property to expand into. So there's a big, you know, mortgage basically. But you know, not particularly horrendous loan to values on that. And I think, you know, the strong get stronger in this business. It's a hard industry to operate in, but if you get it right, it can be absolutely fantastic.
More broadly, what's your sort of perspective on the health of the consumer? Because now we're seeing real wage increases above inflation, i.e. they're about 5 or 6% in nominal terms. But because of inflation's now dropped to around about less than 3%, you're getting a 2.5-3% nominal increase. And just as an anecdotal bit of investment, I understand you're buying a house, so you're feeling you're feeling reasonably bullish. I mean, when I go down, sort of like, you know, restaurants, I mean, not that I go to anything expensive because I'm a bit of a cheapskate, but when I go down the typical Brummy sort of like eating house, then it's quite busy actually. When you'd expect to be busy on a Saturday lunchtime, Sunday lunchtime, in an evening, there's quite a lot of people actually are still splashing the cash.
Yeah, I think we've got a sort of two-speed economy, I would say. And you look at there's some numbers out today on, you know, GDP numbers and and PMI numbers, and you know, services is running hot. And you know, spending on you know, leisure is improving. I think there's a bit of softness in hotels and restaurants in the latest numbers, but you would expect that in a sort of run up to summer when people are thinking about going away, saving their pennies for that long awaited trip overseas, which many people, I've still haven't been overseas for Actually, I don't lie, I went to Paris, but that was the first time in about 4 years.
Did Macron invite you, did he? Along with
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, bien sûr, even. So, I do think the consumer is there are two types of consumer. There are haves and have-nots in the consumer industry. And I think because you've got so many, essentially, I hate using the term, but boomers. Mm. So, you know, people who have largely paid off their mortgage weren't massively affected by the interest rate and inflationary crisis in the sense that they're servicing a debt, have savings which benefited from higher interest rates. They are feeling pretty flush, you know, and that's a fair old chunk of the economy. And you know, when you do go out, you do notice that there's more grey hair than not grey hair in the restaurants out there. So, two types of consumer. At the other end, it's been tough. You know, you look at what happened to Revolution Bars recently. You know, that's trying to attract the young consumer, and they do have all sorts of financial pressures on them, and it really showed up in the struggles that business is facing. Mm. I think loungers is across the board. I think you know, they will because they're sort of family oriented. I think they're a special occasion place, somewhere that your olds are happy to go to. Yeah. So yeah, I think they got the best of both worlds there.
Mm. Yeah, I think you're right. You need to pick your spots as anything. There's a bit of going to be some sort of like, you know, differentiation between not all boats will rise. I did see Wetherspoons increasing the investment in its state, didn't it? And also I think Heineken's doing the same with its brewers. So they wouldn't be investing if they felt as though the sort of the pub/gastro pub type offer was not doing well because they're putting a lot of money in.
I mean, Wetherspoons, it's a funny old business, but it's recovered quite strongly over since, towards the end of last summer. It was really, really out of favour. And I suspect that's as much to do with people don't really like old Tim Martin as much as anything else in the city. but no, it's you go past Wetherspoons, they're always busy because they do cater for, those in society for whom things are a little bit tougher financially. And they, you know, it's a great thing. Yeah. To give that opportunity to people who otherwise, you know, you go, I mean, I live out in sort of holiday country in Suffolk, and some of the prices in pubs are ridiculous.
You come to
London, check out the price of a pint in London. Crikey.
Come to Birmingham, it's a lot cheaper, mate. Okay, right. let's switch bases. We've got a couple of questions from Matthew Roberts. First of all, asking what your thoughts are on Future, and then he sort of pivots to Journeo. Let's start with Future though, because obviously, that's a relatively big cap advertising sort of platform. Links in with the health of the consumer. Mm. It owns Go Compare, I think, doesn't it?
I don't know, to be honest. Yeah, it's not one that I follow.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no. I mean, it owns Go Compare. I mean, okay. I mean, my thoughts on Future. I mean, basically, it's been sold off hard. Two things: one, because it was a pandemic darling. Everybody was moving to online sort of advertising and leveraging its sort of like internet real estate of its magazines. I think it owns Marie Claire and stuff like this. And so it did really well during the pandemic. Unfortunately, then what happened was that obviously interest rates went up. It acquired a lot of brands and built up a big debt pile, and therefore its interest rate went up and people started to get scared about its EBITDA net debt ratio, hence the sell-off. And whether it could generate cash. And I think that then it got a sort of like an iconic chairman came in, Zilla, she left. That's right. I think she was the CEO. She left, which didn't help again with the actual the share price. Anyway, they've got a new sort of CEO in there who's reducing the debt. Go Compare in the cost of living crisis has actually done pretty well, a bit like moneysupermarkets.com. And I'm not sure what PE ratio it trades on, but the last time I looked at this, I don't know if you've got the numbers, John.
I've got the 24 PE is 6.4.
Yeah, exactly. It's well less than 10. Yeah, exactly. So I think the essence of it now, the thesis is that is it going to mean revert back and is it being oversold? And the only danger you get is how you think it could potentially get impacted by, you know, things like regenerative AI if they move to internet discovery using AI, like, you know, Bard and Facebook does, and it locks out some of the big sort of like, you know, internet real estate owners like Future. So that'd be my take on Future.
I mean, you know, having worked in publishing for a long time, it's not a sector I would invest in, I have to say.
That doesn't say much, John.
But it says a lot because, you know, I've seen from the inside how difficult this industry is.
Why is it so difficult? That's really good insight. Why is it so difficult, John?
Because advertising trends have changed massively. You know, so you know, if you were a magazine publisher, you know, 20 years ago, that was all there was. So, if, you know, let's say the Investors Chronicle, you would be stuffed full of advertising. It's where you advertised. If you were, you know, trying to reach the retail financial consumer and as a product provider, as a fund manager or a broker or whatever it might be. And you just saw it, you know, it's just got smaller and smaller and smaller. I think so much of the advertising has been gobbled up by the tech giants, you know, by the Google sponsored links and such the like. But it's just the model has changed. Mm. And it changes all the time. It's really, really difficult. Look at what's happening in newspaper media, the Telegraph Group. You know, the Bartley brothers are trying to sell it. It's an absolute disaster. Mm. You know, stuff full of debt. So it's not a sector that I like. Too much going, too much change, and, you know, more change to come. And as I say, the advertising side of things, as it went digital, it just became so difficult for so many companies. And in Future's case, I mean, you talked about acquisitions. I am mega nervous about companies that are serial acquirers.
Mm. Is that because you're naturally quite sort of a prudent investor, or is that because you just don't like
experience? Acquisitions, I feel have to be targeted, and I prefer, you know, bolt-ons and mega deals. Although a mega deal can work if it's well executed, but acquisitions have to make sense and they have to be thought through. Not, you know, land grab acquisition is a recipe for disaster. Mm. And I have seen over the years, and I'm not saying that Future does this, but it then becomes very difficult to work out when companies acquire a lot how fast they're really growing. Mm. You know, the quality of their revenues, the quality of their earnings. I say serial acquirers, there's an immediate red flag there for me. There was some numbers out today from S4 Capital.
That's a different one, isn't it? A different kettle of fish, S4. They have been, it's Samarty and Sorrel, isn't it?
But again, it was, you know, it's an acquisition vehicle to basically build up something in the digital advertising space, the advertising space. And it's, you know, you've got the double whammy of building up lots of debt to acquire. The acquisitions themselves, you know, I mean, who knows what's working when you have acquiring so much. Yeah. And then you've got this, you know, this horrendously difficult advertising market to boot. So, yeah, not a sector I like, having worked in it for years.
All right, okay. Well, let's move to the other one he had was Journeo. And I know this one, this has been a bit of a rocket ship, hasn't it? I mean, the shares have done extremely well. It's a sort of like a intelligent or smart sort of transport data stroke software hardware provider that puts sort of display screens and information panels into bus routes and also into trains at like Euston and has started now sort of like winning a lot of contracts around the world as well. What's your sort of your latest on Journeo?
Yeah, I mean I like this company, and you know, it's one I mean every company that I'm sort of talking about today is one that is or has been on my watch list. You know, I haven't really bought a lot, but this has been on my watch list for a while, and the prices just kept rocketing, as you say. You know, and I kind of think it sounds incredibly dull. You know,
nothing like really, selling a company there, John.
Well, it does sound incredibly. There's nothing wrong with companies that are boring, as long as they dominate a niche. but you know, it doesn't sound very exciting, you know, bus times on displays. You know, this is not stuff that really sort of excites you when you think about
it is if you're waiting at a bus stop and it's been tipping down with rain, it's -5 and you've had to wait 10 minutes and you're sort of like looking for the number 51 bus to arrive.
It must excite you in that moment, but generally speaking, when you're contemplating bus timetables, it's not the most exciting thing in the world. But you know, and here is a case of a company that's acquired well. You know, it's so it bought a company called MultiQ. It's bought, you know, a presence overseas, basically, sort of Nordics and Europe, and you know, there are a lot of transport networks out there.
Yeah.
So you know, to build up a dominant position in this niche is absolutely fantastic. It's exactly what you want to see from a small company expanding, you know, and it's done it on a very, very prudent basis as well. You know, it's let me have a look. I can't have lost my net sheet.
I mean, I think the CEO, Russ Singleton, he used to run Synetics, I think it was, years and years ago. And so he knows actually how to build and acquire and bolt on acquisitions as well as organic growth. So he's been there, done the badge, experienced management. I did actually meet them at Mello about 12 months ago. I was really impressed because they're trying to put in some more recurring revenue streams, higher value software in there as well, on top of the hardware. And the key is you can't just rock up and win a contract with these blue chip customers. You have to have a track record, and you've got to be, you know, security cleared and all this sort of stuff. So, there's a lot of barriers to entry into this market.
But that's why acquisitions are important in this case, as long as they're well executed, because they give you that immediate presence. You know, you're not going after a new market as a sort of challenger upstart. You know, as I say, they've done all this very prudently. So, you know, they're still sitting on net cash. Yeah, as far as my numbers tell me, and you know the forecasts are, sort of forecast valuation is extremely low. You know, we're looking at a PE of 12 and a bit for this year. You know,
well, it sounds as though it should be on your watch list, there, John.
It is on my watch list.
No, it shouldn't be. It should be in your portfolio.
Well, yeah, but then you know you look at that price. I mean, and I hear it again. It's when I sort of sat back and thought, yeah, I'll wait for a little entry point, and just you know never did it. But I, you know, and here is another sort of thing that I've been considering recently. And you know, it's, you know, when a company is demonstrating momentum and that price is higher than it's been for a while, is that's the time potentially to buy? You know, the growth is not behind this company; it's ahead of it. So it might not stay on the watch list for much longer.
Oh, okay.
Not sure. I bought a Pullbeg. I bought more the other day after it jumped a substantial amount.
I think the thing to really take away is that you've identified it sometime before it ended up to be a winner. And the point is such that you can't own everything you like. You have
I could
to
have
pick
owned
and, well, no, no, but you can't. You simply can't own everything you like. And you just got to basically pick your stocks and stick by them. And some of them, you know, that you'd love to own them, but you can't. So, you know, it's one of those things. I know you could have owned that one. Okay, we've got another question coming in from Ross G333. He asks about would be interested in your thoughts on the recent events at Argentex. I know Paul had mentioned the company was in his portfolio previously, and he says he holds it as well. I don't know whether you heard anything. I can give an update on this one, John.
I don't follow this story.
Yeah, okay. I mean, basically, this is a white glove Forex services expert that helps sort of like corporates, large B2B corporates, fund managers, and high net worth individuals do overseas payments. And it does most of its business over the telephone and on a white glove, a personalized, tailored situation. And it has been trying to build its own technology platform. And it was doing well up to sort of 6 to 8 months ago on that. Unfortunately, they had, well, The CEO left, and the CFO also left, and because they wanted to pivot the strategy to more sort of like straight through processing, which absolutely makes perfect sense to me, because I know quite a lot about this space, etc. So you could then get the best of both worlds. Unfortunately, what's happened is that they've had 6 months doing a strategic review. They've announced the plan, which seems to work in the southern strategy, but the implementation of that strategy, to me as an investor, is too long. It takes take them 2 years to implement and to monetize, and is too expensive because they're going to take some of their spare cash and take on a bit more debt to do it. And by the risk is, by the time they actually fully complete it and have this unified technology platform and expert sort of like Forex advisory and dealing service, once you gel those two together, it will be out of date. So I personally think they should look at to do, rather than build it in-house, they should buy it, or they should license it or white label it off somebody else. The shares currently are just at rock bottom levels. I own them. I'm down. I'm in the red. I've lost another one which has gone pear-shaped on me, but I'm not selling at these levels because I actually think there's a chance that they could they've got the right strategy. They could just change that implementation approach. And if they do that, then this one could do really well over the next sort of 2 to 3 years. But I think we need to be patient. You know, it's just one of those things. I've lost quite a bit of money on it. Okay, there's one. Just while we're here, I might as well. There's another company which is a bit smaller in that space. It's called Cornerstone FX, and I thought I'd just raise this one. Let me put the chart on in a moment. This one is does more sort of like straight through processing. It does sort of like spot transactions are about 90% of it. Again, it's a white glove sort of service, but as you can see from the chart, it's really sort of turned. And one of your ex-colleagues from Investors Chronicle loves it as well, Simon Thompson. I don't own this. I wish I did, simply because, but I'm most massively overweight international payments. I own Equals, PayPal, and Argentex. And this one's a bit smaller. I can't really get in with volume to a certain extent. But anyway, they came out with their results earlier this week. I interviewed the management team. Their sales doubled over the last 12 months. That's how successful this business has been. It went from like 4.8 to 9.6 million pounds. It's going to do another sort of near 20% growth this year to 11.5 million. I think that's modest. They're cash generative, they positive EBITDA, and they've got net funds on their balance sheet. And they're doing a very much a sort of like an organic growth strategy with hopefully do some selective acquisitions at some point in time. They're expanding not only in the UK and winning market share, but also, and usually it's market share from the banks they're winning it from, but they're all also expanding internationally into Canada, going forward, it hopes in the UAE and also into Hong Kong. They're only about a 20 million market cap company. There was an updated note from their house broker, Shore Capital, which comes up with a price target of 70p up from 50p. And I think there's a long, long way. The guy who runs it, James Hickman, used to work for Equals. He really is as sharp as a razor, and he knows what he's doing. He's been here before. He lives and breathes the payments industry. He seems to get this. You know, And you know, I genuinely, I think they're in a really good spot. They've got something which works very well, and you know, they're growing very. I mean, let's be clear about it. How many businesses are doubling their turnover every 12 months?
Quite. Quite. Interesting that you mentioned, you know, it's the experience behind that business, and you know the troubles that Argentex has had at the sort of yes. board level. I think, you know, management really does matter. Really matters. And you know, again, going back to XP Factory Lounges, you know, really strong management teams. It's a hard thing to judge, actually, but you know, have a dig
around. How do you judge it, John?
Sometimes you clearly get a good feel when you speak to someone. So if you get the opportunity to chat to a chief exec, that can be very helpful. Although you always have to remember that their job is to sell their company. And they're very, very good at it. But you know, you just have a dig around a lot of the time. And you know, you can find what people have done, what their CV looks like, how successful they've been, basically. But yeah, it's an important thing. It's one of the hardest things to judge, but also one of the most important factors in investing.
Yeah, I just generally have a sort of like a full sort of factor approach when it comes to stock picking: company, industry or sector, price value, and the fourth one is management. And the management is equally as important, if not more important than any of the other three, but is so difficult to actually properly gauge. And it can change as well. You can basically have a really energized CEO one moment, and then 12 months later, he goes through a divorce, or there's a bereavement in his family, or he moves house, John. and then his priorities change, or he gets married, or whatever it is, and suddenly, you know, the sort of the edge that he brings, what I look for fundamentally in a management team and a CEO is not only capability, expertise, and experience, it's hunger. Somebody who's basically lives and breathes it, loves what they're doing, and you know they will turn every stone when and you can be guaranteed there will be, when there are problems around the corner, they'll try and move heaven and earth to solve those issues.
Yeah, I mate, you're right. And you know, I think sometimes skin in the game is an important part of that. So you know, where you have a sort of founder manager, founder chief exec, I think that is that is a very important characteristic. You know, so guys that have been around, they've built these companies from scratch. I'm not a fan of sort of the parachuted in management you often see in sort of FTSE 100 companies. You know, it seems like a sort of merry-go-round of jobs for the boys and girls. But founder,
you sound a cynic there, John.
I am a cynic when it comes to sort of executive pay for some managers usually at the larger end of the market. I think at the smaller end of the market, you see these entrepreneurs, you know, genuine entrepreneurs who, as you say, live and breathe the companies that they run and have built from often nothing. Richard Hart from XP Factory is a good example. Alex Cheeto at Ten Lifestyle. You know, shares aren't doing so well, but you know, that guy's built that up, and he had his idea and he's executed on it, and he lives and breathes that business. And I think that will come good.
Yeah, I know, I would agree. And I wouldn't, you hear a lot about this sort of skin in the game, and it's important. I'm not dissing it, etc., but I take it slightly one further. It's soul in the game. It's somebody who, yes, they might have some financial, but their desire and their hunger is beyond remuneration. It's beyond share price. It's basically success. They love what they're doing. They would do it on a small salary, and because they want to achieve. They get such a kick out of what they do, and there aren't that many people around who do it. But when you meet them as CEOs, you can tell. Because they're just like steamrollers, and they'll just basically love it, and they'll just get into it.
Yeah, well, Tim Martin at Wetherspoon is a good example. Not everyone's cup of tea, and again, someone else who is not everyone's cup of tea, Mike Ashley at Frasers. We'll talk about them in another context shortly. But he has no salary. You know, he ran that business for many years with no salary, and look how it's performed.
Yeah,
he wants to win. And, you know, sometimes I think you can go a bit far in that ruthlessness and, you know, a desire to, you know, for domination, not global domination, it's obviously UK domination, but yeah, it's a hunger. There's a hunger there.
Yeah. Okay, good. Well, let's move to another sort of tech play. Let's go to, I think it's a cybersecurity, it's Crossword Cybersecurity, which is more of a consultant, I think, in the UK that you quite like. And the shares haven't performed particularly well, but have they reached a sort of a bottom? I think the market cap is pretty small, isn't it?
Yes, it's a small one, but I think, you know, this market is so interesting. You know, it's we saw the other day Darktrace got taken out. You know,
yeah, that's more of a software platform, and it was run by Tomo Brahma, wasn't it? For 30 times EBITDA.
That's right. So you know, but actually, you know, what Darktrace were doing was sort of AI enabled cybersecurity. And as you rightly say, it was more a software product. Crossword has been more consultancy, but they're building that product side of things as well. So I spoke to them the other day, I just think it's such an important market. You know, we live in a connected world. The threats. The cyber attacks threats are getting worse. And, you know, we had some reports this week of, you know, some major cyber attacks on sort of UK government. We see them on business all the time. It's a real and present threat, in this sort of asymmetric war that we seem to be in. It's all going to change again because, you know, AI comes along and, you know, the sophistication of the attackers improves. So the sophistication of defense has to improve. It is an arms race.
What's the USP here, John, compared to obviously they must compete against IBM, Accenture, I don't know, Capgemini and all the big accountants?
Yeah, well, no. I mean, as we said, they've got a sort of software platform that's part of it. But you know, they're more an across the board provider. I think, you know, from my perspective, the interesting thing is they are small. They are an up and coming cybersecurity company rather than sort of one of the big boys. And you know, the aim will be, you know, there is the opportunity to go from this consultancy business, which, as I'm sure you know, is sort of more lumpy than the sort of lower margin than a pure software business. But the opportunity is to change the mix of the company and increase the recurring revenues from product. So I think this is more, from to my mind, about the opportunity than what has come before. You know, they're doing a lot of partnerships. They're getting a lot of sort of attention in the industry because of some of the work that they're doing. Good management again. Tommy Lube is the chief exec, and he is a serial entrepreneur. And you've got a guy called Stuart Jubb, who is sort of managing director. He's sort of his background is ex-military. So, you know, these guys know what they're doing in terms of getting this company to where it needs to be. Let's say, you know, that the opportunity is the products that are coming through, that the development that will shift that mix in the company. It's got cash in the balance sheet, narrowing its losses. So yeah, I just quite like it. I think it's quite interesting, and I think cybersecurity is a real hot area.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a sort of like also a play on AI, isn't it? Generative AI, the amount 100%. Of imposters in terms of, you know, people doing voice, you know, trying to actually copy somebody's voice or video or whatever it is and stuff like that. So yeah, these sort of attack vectors have just multiplied hugely for corporates. So the stakes have got much, much higher. And when you have states essentially like Russia and China, Iran, and all the other, you know, all the other ones, North Korea attacking UK and Europe and all the other Western, not only for industrial espionage, but actually military sites and stuff like, you're right. It's a massive, it's a massive growth area. Okay,
funny enough, I saw a report. There was this, I think it was the inaugural World Cybersecurity Report the other day, and you'd be surprised where a lot of the hacks come from. So yeah, you're right. Russia and China are obviously up there, but the UK and the US are the source of many a hack, although one could imagine that they are more about theft than anything else.
Yeah. It's not just one way. I get it. Okay, we've got another question from Matthew Roberts. He's asking for facilities by ADF. I don't know whether you have a look at this one. It basically does.
I own this.
Oh, good man. Okay, right. That's Andy. Then you can give an update then.
Well, I can't remember what I've done.
Everything
seems to be moving in the right direction. I mean, you know, they were hit hard by the Hollywood riot strike. So you know, and I think we spoke about this one last time. That, you know, it just took a long time for that situation to stabilize. So, you know, growth is still there, but it's been, you know, the margin has been hit because they've had to use sort of you know, more sort of contract drivers, that sort of thing, which is slightly more expensive. They've had to support more smaller productions than some of the bigger ones that perhaps they had in the past. So yeah, there's been a margin hit here. As a consequence, you know, profits have gone backwards. So you know, a bad year, you would say, for this company. Now, the other thing I noticed the other day, and this is a strange one. I was looking for some reason, I spent my morning looking at the trades that were going through on various companies. And I noticed some selling in this one, and it was sort of block trades. So, you know, sort of 5,000 shares, 10,000 shares. And these all happened throughout the course of a morning. And I thought, someone's selling down a position here. So then I had a look at who the biggest shareholders were. And it's a company called the Business Growth Fund. Owns a lot of this company. Business Growth Fund was set up. Yeah, I didn't know this. Are you aware of the Business Growth Fund?
Yeah. It basically does private companies, list them. It does early stage companies.
It also does listed companies.
It's EI stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting though, but it's owned by the big banks. And it was it was forced to be set up in the wake of the financial crisis. But my worry here is, I mean, it's very opaque, I would say, in terms of how it operates. And, you know, it doesn't invite outside investment. And I think it's, you know, its main purpose is to recycle that capital to keep putting back into private companies. So what I think about ADF is, whilst I really like the business, and I think that, you know, it's got a dominant position in the UK, I think that, you know, the sort of film and TV industry is only sort of getting bigger and bigger and bigger, you know.
John? I mean, that's the sort of the question mark, I think, for the reason for the share price. And the reason why I say that is because, other than Netflix, all the big major studios and movies houses, etc., are cutting back their schedule. They're doing fewer movies and more of the big blockbuster stuff. So the number of outside requirements in terms of sort of like, you know, on-site videos and showing is actually is less than they'd previously done pre-pandemic.
Well, I mean, you know, this sort of, you would imagine, you would always expect this industry to sort of swing around in that sort of sense. But you look at the latest results, you know, it's sort of customer share. It gave a lot of detail. I'm just going to dig it up. You can see exactly who it's working with. So you know, it's grown its revenues from Apple. It's grown its revenues from the BBC. It's grown its revenues from Channel 4. Grown its revenues from Disney. So you know, and there is a lot of investment going into studios in the UK. So, in fact, the one it didn't grow its investment, its revenue from was Netflix. So,
know, I mean, it says to me, to a certain extent, it's either a value play or a value trap, because
it's a value play for sure. I mean, in my mind, it's
you would definitely say it is, because all the movies during the pandemic which were put off and the writer's strike should be coming through, and that's the logical to. But you have seen likes of Universal, Disney, MGM. They're all saying the same thing. We're cutting our slate of movies worldwide. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to impact the UK movie industry, which is leading edge. But it just means that the pie worldwide is likely not to be expanding in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to contract, you know, massively, if at all. I mean, I haven't seen the numbers. You know, it's a big industry, which I would expect to continue growing over time. And, you know, as you say, you know, it's about how Facilities by Def plays it. And it's, you know, it's increasing. It's broadening its revenues from its customer base. So I'm not worried about that. As what I am worried about is its overhang. It's massive overhang. Okay.
Somebody's selling. Hey, if that's just technical, then you're right. It's a total value play, because that will correct at some point in time. Okay, let's just switch to early stage life sciences and healthcare. There was some quite big news on a popular share of Vactor, which came out last week, and it came out with this one does sort of precision chemo warhead type or targeted drugs and stuff, drug development. Its lead candidate, AVA6000, is going through phase 1 clinical trials, has had really good efficacy and safety data, particularly on the safety data. More efficacy will come out in phase 2. Anyway, what they did, they put out their prelims, which are all in line, which is fine. They've got a 2-year cash runway to develop the product. And they've just now appointed their head of R&D, Christina Coughlin, as the CEO. So they've had a sort of management reshuffle, and that's really as much as I wanted to say. The idea is that she's got more expertise in this, the precision platform, which is their chemo-targeted warhead drug development, and they're likely to, at some point, sell their diagnostics business, which should generate them some more cash. And then once you've done that, then the business should become an absolute dedicated, you know, precision chemo or oncology business. And on that basis, it should attract more sort of institutional healthcare money who want to go into biotech and into oncology. There was an interesting report which came out from Morgan Stanley a couple of weeks ago or a couple of months ago, and they talked about targeted or precision chemotherapies going forward, and there's two big healthcare themes at the moment: the GPL-1 anti-obesity drugs, and then this precision or the targeted chemotherapies. Largely, they're talking about I can't remember what they're the type of immunotherapy type of stuff. I can't remember exactly what it is. ADCs, that's it, I think they're called. But also the precision platform falls into it. Anyway, the shares have done poorly of late because they've had a big refinancing. So I just really wanted to give people an update on how the business is, and with a bit of luck, you know, they'll continue to knock the ball out of the park with their phase one and when they go into phase 2 next year, because that's the key. When you come to drug development, it's all how the actual therapeutics perform in the lab first, and then getting FDA approval and getting commercialization.
I mean, the cancer opportunity is massive, particularly the immunotherapy side of things, but you know, I'm playing that a slightly different way, which is Poolbeg, is this companion therapy.
Okay, good. Well, let's move to another area. Let's go to Hargreaves Lansdown, which is the sort of like the online sort of like investment platform that for retail investors. And it's been through the mill of recently through things like the consumer duty and having to pass on extra sort of like, you know, reduce its costs and fees it charges, but also the amount of interest it can leverage from the cash balances from its customers and stuff like this. But it came out with some a pretty good and optimistic trading update just recently. I think it's had a good, it's improved its customer service and it's had a good uptick at the in the April tax year when people start putting money into ISAs and also into SIPs. I don't know what your latest on this one is.
Yeah, I'm just keeping an eye on this because, you know, it's a giant. I mean, I've got a Hargreaves account and, you know, my experience of it is that it's really, really very good. Mm. You know, it's an interesting market. You know, it had largely this market to itself and there is some sort of some stiff competition coming up the rails in the form of AJ Bell and Interactive Investor, which is now owned by Aberdeen. And, you know, it's true that, you know, Hargreaves was taking the mickey a little bit in terms of the cash balances and got caught. Got caught a little bit out in the Neil Woodford debacle as well, you know, which affected sentiment quite badly and had underinvested. It had underinvested in its platform. So you know, you had a sort of a perfect storm of problems here and then sort of chucking a really weak UK equity market and you know, and it's just everything went wrong at the same time for this company. But it's still the biggest broker in the UK. It's still very profitable, even though, you know, profitability has been declining, sort of margins. It's still bringing in new customers and adding new business, and we're at the beginning of a recovery in the market cycle. And you look at the share price, you know, and where are we?
It's about a 5.5% dividend yield and about 12.5 times PE ratio, I think.
Let's have a look. Yep. And, you know, it's sort of traded, what is the price? £8.40 a share or thereabouts. And, you know, this is traded at 24 quid in the past. And, yeah, maybe it won't get back there again because, you know, you say, will it ever recover the margins that it had because competition is that much greater? You know, the regulator it has its eye on it, you would think, in terms of, you know, things like the sort of cash on interest, interest on cash rather. But you know, you'd certainly expect it to get out of these doldrums. Mm. You know, looking very, very. It's actually had a little bit of a jump recently.
No, it came out with a positive trading update. That's why. Yeah. But I mean, in terms of
that moving average line, which is kind of interesting.
I mean, is the secular tailwinds in this area, John?
I mean, you would hope so. You would think so. I mean, the secular tailwind has got to be that you start seeing, you know, more inflows into UK equities. You know, and I know you can trade internationally through Hargreaves and other brokers, but the reality is, you know, when it comes to investing, most people are very parochial. You tend to shop at home. So you know, and even if you are, you know, looking to invest internationally, you would tend to do it through funds and trusts or even ETFs, which you can trade through Hargreaves. So you know, a tailwind of you know, improved investor confidence will surely be a secular. You would hope it's secular because people always need to invest and arguably need to invest more than they have done in the past in pensions and such alike.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an interesting stat which comes out from the States, actually, to underpin the secular side of it. In America, I think there's something like 1 in 4 people, adults, have their own brokerage account. Yeah. In the UK, it's like 1 in 20 or 1 in 15. There's a sort of like a 4-to-5-to-1 ratio of, you know, in more people. And it'll mean revert at some point. It'll migrate. The UK will migrate more to the States where people take their own responsibility and DIY and do it themselves on the likes of Interactive Brokers, Hargreaves Lansdown and AJ Bell.
Well, it has to happen because, you know, once upon a time, you know, lots of people worked for companies that provided them with, you know, really, really good pensions, you know, offered to the final salary pensions. Most of those have gone unless you work in the public sector. And, you know, pension provision is not what it used to be. So people do. You know, if you want to enjoy a comfortable retirement, you have to take matters into your own hands, and therefore you have to, you have to open a SIP or something. Or, you know, you can do, it's so expensive to invest, but you can just drip feed into regular savings plan, put some money away.
Mm.
Stop spending it on rubbish.
I've been putting into too much rubbish recently, but
don't worry.
Right.
Don't worry.
Yeah, that's aimed at me. That's aimed at me. That is okay. Right. There's a question from Neil Seddon. Hello. Do you have any views on U Group, a real rocket ship in the last 12 months? Obviously, this is this sort of like a challenger energy supplier for B2B, isn't it? And I think there's a really passionate CEO. Is it Bobby Caldor?
I've spoken to him before. Great business.
Yeah,
really. Well,
I think the share price is even better than the business, isn't it?
what we've done here. It's sort of,
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, basically, it was sort of 50p, wasn't it? It's not so long ago.
Well, yeah, more than 10 bag then. If you're looking back at £2, it's they've got to near 20. But yeah, no, it's cracking business.
Mm.
Absolutely cracking business.
So is the momentum going to continue then? I guess, John, is the question.
I mean. With momentum, that is always $1 million question. Momentum always works until it doesn't.
We've had three of those today already.
Yeah. I think we might have another one to come. Is anything going to change here to materially affect the business in a negative way? And, you know, you can't see that happening. You know, this is, again, you know, the energy market has been dysfunctional. And you know, companies want better service, more reliable pricing, as do homeowners. So you know, this is a solution to a dysfunctional energy market, and potentially this is the way the market will develop. I can't see anything coming along to knock it off its tracks. And the forecasts, you know, I mean, this year they're down a little bit, but we've been through an exceptionally strange period.
Yeah.
But the trajectory, you know, looking from 24 to 25 onwards, is still up.
Mm. Yeah, and I would say, I mean, one thing which has happened with the Ukraine-Russia war, because it shot the gas price to the moon and blew up so many of its competitors, then the people who come through the other side, then frankly, they're the winners and they've got a critical mass. And people, if you can survive the volatility of that, you know, that incident, then, you know, you're almost like you've built up huge amounts of barriers to entry because the regulator is just not going to allow every mum and dad to sort of, you know, mum and pop to set up a new energy company. So I think actually the underlying value of that business for the people who are still there, like the U Group, is stronger than it's ever been.
I mean, there is another factor, actually, just looking at this. I mean, it's massively cash generative. But what I'm noticing, just having a quick look through numbers, which I haven't looked at for a while, hence this very, very quick look, debt is disappearing fast. In fact, it's swinging very, very rapidly towards net cash.
Mm.
So, you know, the more cash in the business, the lower the value of the equity, you know, as a proportion of the market cap, essentially. So you know, that sort of that share price almost doesn't reflect entirely just the sort of the operational performance. It reflects the fact this cash is flooding into the business. Forecast we're talking forecast net cash of, you know, I've lost the number, 105 million by the end of 2024, or financial year 2024. So yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary, that level of cash generation.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I'd like to just again highlight one which is just pivoting to another sort of software company, but is also winning a lot of market share, is Fidel Partners. And this one is an international royalty software platform for licensees, licensors, and you know, companies. And it's got a blue chip customer base that you'd die for, the likes of Pearson's, you know, the ex Investors Chronicle guys. It's got Hasbro, Sanofi, masses, Coca-Cola, lots and lots of major blue chip brands, because the complexity of running royalties and licensing them out and collecting licenses is just so enormous now, particularly with the fragmented market. These guys own, it's quite a niche market, about over 20, I think it's over 25% of the market that they have. And they listed just over a year ago onto AIM with the idea that they're going to basically grow organically and do bolt acquisitions. They've grown already organically. They had their sales were up 10% last year to £14.5 million, but their ARR, because they're shifting more towards a SaaS model, was up 31%. They've got cash on the balance sheet. It's more of the same. They do, their gross margins are well over 60%, they're about over 65%, but they're increasing because they're having more of a software element rather than services. The only downside at the moment is actually liquidity is not great on it. So if you want to put in a big number, which I would do, I can't actually get into this stock at the moment, but they are trying to sort that out in terms of moving the listing from a Reg S into a normal AIM share so it can get put onto things like Hargreaves Lansdown. But actually the reason that I'd say stick this on your watch list, because it's like, well, the business is a bit like a rocket ship. The share price hasn't moved simply because there's not that much, you know, liquidity, and that's a problem. But that will resolve itself. That's a technical issue. But as I say, it's the number one in terms of royalty management, and its blue chip customer base is fantastic. Plus, it's just introduced a new bit of software that serves all small and medium cap companies that is more out the box in terms of, within a few, you know, days, you can start running the royalty calculations. And then the other side of the business is like the brand protection, brand vision, they call it, which is AI generated and stops in effectively bad actors ripping off other people's brands on an AI. So if you were Coca-Cola, for instance, and you've got a lot of people who are just taking your image and using it illegally on Twitter and Facebook and people like that, their software would identify it and take it down for them, which is just a massive benefit for for corporates and stuff. So it's one to watch, that's for sure.
IP protection? Always been.
Yeah, exactly. And it'll be beneficiary of AI as well, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, let's move to construction. We've got a couple of them. We've got Vistry that I know you quite like, and that's been a bit of a rocket ship, hasn't it?
Oh, don't. Again, this is another one I thought. Do you remember we spoke? Oh, my goodness. It must have been a good year or two ago.
Yeah.
The house builders.
Yeah, you were negative on house builders, weren't you?
Well, no, I was negative on house builders, and, you know, and rightly so. I mean, they continue to really struggle for quite some time after we spoke. But I remember talking about, you know, I think the problem house builders have had is that they have had a lot of government support in the form of Help to Buy, which has really meant that they've sort of knocked up these estates, these housing estates, and charged, you know, quite a lot of money for what has been in many cases inferior products. So I think you got into this year when you've seen, you know, housing completions from the house builders, you know, absolutely decimated. Mm. You know, sort of outputs absolutely trashed in a lot of cases. So you had a low, you know, in the market. When would that have been? Sort of about October. Well, it was about, there was a full storm, you know. And I remember, I must have talked to you or Justin about it, but Vistry was the one that jumped out to me at the time because they had gone early on what they called partnership model. So working with local authorities to basically develop affordable social housing.
They bought Countryside Properties as well, which did 100% effectively affordable properties, affordable housing.
Yeah, and you know, and so I, you know, I think we have a housing crisis in this country, and the sort of the way the market has operated, and, you know, some of the schemes used to kind of plug the hole we have, things like Help to Buy haven't really worked to solve the crisis. They've worked to make some people very rich. But they haven't solved the problem. And the problem is that a lot of people just simply can't afford to buy houses at the prices volume house builders are trying to charge for them. You know, housing affordability has been stretched beyond imagination. I think I saw a stat that says, you know, it's more difficult to buy a house in 2024 than it was in 1894. Mm. You know, so
I wouldn't say, yeah, I wouldn't put that at the feet of the house builders. That was all to do with interest rates going down to zero, which meant it was so affordable to buy. You put a 5-year mortgage rate at sort of like 3%, and now that it's all rolling off, you've had a shock to the system as it's gone up to normal. I mean, the first
that should always be built into, you know, the sort of mortgage safety You know, and sort of, as I say, you know, house builders have made a lot of money. A lot of it was returned to shareholders in the form of dividends, and management did not shy away from paying themselves a pretty penny at some of these companies. So yeah, they know how to operate. They make money, house builders, and they haven't solved the problem. You know, if you're an industry, and this is something I like to see as well, if there is a problem, then companies should be trying to solve it with what they offer, rather than just trying to purely profit. And I felt the house building industry was very guilty of simply profiteering from a problem, rather than, you know, attempting to solve it. You know, if they want to help plug the housing crisis, build more homes, but no, because that will affect their margins. So Countrywide went early on a partnership model, and I think that's where we're going to see a lot more activity, and that's reflected in its share price. And again, yeah, I missed the boat on it. Yeah. Missed the boat on it, or have I?
Okay, we've got another question from Paddy MHBS. He says, any thoughts on Marston's, which basically is the pub group, isn't it? Which it's actually got some pretty good pubs around here. It does Ego and all kinds of stuff, which is really nice, actually.
Oh, I haven't looked at Marston's, I have to say.
Oh, okay.
All right. Very cheap.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, they're, yeah. What's the ticker on Marston's, do you know?
M-A-R-S.
M-A-R-S. Yeah, that's it. Mars, isn't it? Yeah, gotcha.
Very cheap. Lots of debt.
Oh, okay. Well, what's the PE on it then?
4.4. Net borrowing, 1.6 billion.
Wow. The shares, the reason for the question, it's obvious the shares have done very well recently. That has got to be a barometer of how investors are perceiving the health of the consumer, in my view.
No, I think the whole sector was very much written off.
Yeah.
For dead. And you know, I think there's going to be some natural recovery in the share price across the sector. But it's a tough old business, you know, contending with all sorts of things. You know, the sort of inflation has really hit pubs hard. You know, the cost of heating them, cost of energy, the cost of cooking, the cost of food ingredients, the cost of staff, the ability to even hire staff. There are so many pressures in this industry. Mm. It's one that, you know, I think you have to really be able to differentiate, which is why I like lounges as my preferred play in this sector.
I think there's a broader
horror stories in the pub industry.
Yeah, I think there's a broader point here, to be perfectly honest, because the stock market typically moves before the economy. And I think this is another barometer. The housing, the house builders, you've got the restaurant guys, the good operators, their share prices are moving because it's likely that the economy is getting better in 6 months' time. I think this is a really good sign. And the banks have done the same, John. Mm. That says to me, actually, the UK economy is doing better than the stats say at the moment.
No, absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, we're out of recession. And I just had a quick look at the last trading update, which was January, and, you know, up 10%. But then, you know, we've had a couple of cancelled Christmases. So I'm not sure whether we're seeing, you know, where things will settle back to in terms of sort of like-for-like growth rates in this industry. And, you know, I mean, I see pubs around here. A lot of them are up for sale. You know, it's hard to
you should buy one, but I suppose if you just bought a house, can you?
I'm not buying a pub.
Absolutely. I know. Well, it'd be a nice pastime. We've got another one from Nigel. He's basically asking about Chrysalis Investments, which I think is a similar to, is it, Hypnosis, isn't
it? Music royalties.
Music royalties. And I guess this is the same sort of thing because music royalties or because of Hypnosis got the bid from Blackstone and from another one, then they think takeover just here as well, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the interesting thing to look at, what's the discount on it? Has it got me an investment trust screen up? I haven't looked at Chrysalis. I mean, the Hypnosis thing was, a mess, to put it mildly. And it, you know, it had paid a lot of money for these royalties. You know, the sort of few, if anything is interest rate sensitive, it's revenue streams, royalty streams that are going to come from the future. So they got absolutely whacked. And there's all sorts of shenanigans going on there as well. And I don't know what it got taken out at, but I forget it. But it was way below what it got to. Just looking at Chrysalis, it's trading at a 40% discount to net assets. And you know what that essentially is telling you, that people don't trust the valuations of the assets.
Or it's undervalued, John.
Or it's undervalued. But no, undervalued means people don't trust the value of the assets that it's stating.
Yeah, okay.
So that would be because, you know, there's uncertainty about the value of those future revenue streams. The music industry. I mean, Hypnosis, the guy that ran it, Merck Mercurio, I think that was his name. He was involved in a company called Sanctuary Records. I'm not a fan of music.
Yeah,
I love music, and I love, as you know, but the music industry, nah.
Yeah, no, it had. I think it had a checkered history, Hypnosis, to say the least. Okay, just on the discounts to net assets, I know there's one you've sort of piqued my interest, is Life Science REIT.
Yeah. Lamps.
And this one seems to be trading at 50% discount to net assets. It specializes in medical labs sciences, doesn't it? Basically building medical properties and stuff like that, because we've got a big deficit in the UK.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's, you know, and it's a key sector for the UK, the life sciences sector. Commercial property is having a horrible, horrible time.
Tell me
nobody wants it. Basically, so I'm going to see if I can find, you know, even things that were absolute. I'm just going to sort that list.
I had an EPRA net asset value, the last one of 80p. It trades at 40 at the moment.
Yep. Let's have a look at something like Tritex Big Box. I mean, that was this does sort of logistics warehousing. Went mad during the lockdown because everyone was shopping from home and no one was ever going to visit a shop ever again. But, you know, you've got another one, Urban Logistics. That's trading at a 26% discount as well. You know, these are proven assets and proven operating models. So there is just, you know, it's just a sector that is incredibly out of favour.
Is this a value trap or a value play then, John?
Well, I haven't decided yet, but I'm kind of erring on the side. I'm erring on the side of value play.
So am I. I think you've raised a brilliant anomaly here in terms of valuation, because I know in that golden triangle between Oxford, Cambridge and London, there is such a shortage of quality, you know, high grade healthcare lab space. And these guys should be a perfect play into it in terms of, you know, there'll be so many people who need those, and the government need to be able to invest in this type of area. I think it's a bit like data centers. I think this is a growth area.
I think so. Funny enough, you know, data centers, not a big fully fledged ones, but you know, sort of high end computing, big, you know, data rooms are part of the things that it offers. You know, labs are increasingly high tech. It's not just Bunsen burners and test tubes these days. So actually, there's a lot of work that goes into basically, you know, either building these things from scratch or converting office blocks into, you know, facilities that are suitable for use in the life sciences industry. And as I say, that's both lab based and sort of the data analysis behind it. Interestingly, just as an aside, hVIVO is building a big lab and flu clinic in, as we spoke about before, in Canary Wharf. And it's, you know, it's basically converting office space, which has sort of fallen, become surplus to requirements. So big shortage, as you say, in the life sciences industry, massive growth area for the UK, huge government support for this industry. And it's in all the right places. It's in all the right places. Just having a look at the last numbers. I mean, it had to rebase its dividend, which is why, you know, I think that share price has come under pressure. But you know, it's growing its rental income. As you would expect, the expertise within this group to be able to deliver this property, you know, is significant.
Yeah.
So I like it. I think with this one, you know, I play a waiting game sometimes to see if I can get the best price. Sometimes it works against me. For example, but in this case, I think I've waited long enough, and I'm very tempted by this one.
Yeah, you sound as a man to my own heart there, waiting until it gets to hopefully the bottom price and you pile in. Okay, well, it'd be remiss of me not to ask you about sort of Fintel, which is basically, I mean, I've been covering this stock for like 2 or 3 years, and I've been stupid. I'm in an hour and about whether I should buy it, and I've always said it's a great stock, real quality management team, and you know secular growth, and they've delivered and haven't been in it. So tell me what your latest thoughts are on this one, because great company in terms of sort of financial services, IFAs and stuff.
Yeah, I had the same sort of thinking. It was sort of bobbling along, and I was thinking, oh, I'll have a dabble in this at some point. And it just went whoosh.
Yeah.
I missed it. But again, have I missed it? So maybe now is the time to I'm going to be paying a bit more, but so what? Because this is a business that is super high quality. Mm. As you rightly say, you know, fantastic management team. So I usually speak to, it's got two CEOs. I always thought that was a bit odd. And then I was speaking to one of them, Matt Timmins, the other day, and he just made it all, you know, make sense, which was that they are doing so much that they need two CEOs to execute. Mm. You know, they're doing a lot on the M&A front. And, you know, whilst I said earlier that I'm cautious about companies that are serial acquirers, you know, there is a real blueprint about how it's building up this business. You know, it's building this platform for the IFA market, for the IFA industry. Retail distribution is in essence, and it's almost treated as like a jigsaw. Mm. It's taking it gets a little bit here, a little bit here, very fragmented, and pulling it all together. And then it's got this thing called Fintel Labs as well, which is sort of investing from the bottom up in almost sort of like a VC style. And it's taking those products and building, you know, the technology that comes out of them into its offer. And it's just, I mean, yeah, this is, you talk about hunger, you know, you can see it in this company.
Yeah.
And real focused hunger as well.
It's high gross margins using economics. Yeah. It's got high now recurring revenue streams. It's mainly sort of software and data and services and stuff like this. It's got good sort of like, you know, single digit, strong single digit, you know, organic growth. But with your bolt-on acquisitions, it all drops down to the bottom line. And people say, okay, well, it's moved a lot from £2 or from 1.40 it was a few years ago, etc. And is it what's a sort of like, you know, is it, have I missed it? Well, when you just look at the sort of the EBITDA multiple, it's less than 14. And I know for private businesses on these, it's 15 to 20 times, no doubt about it, for this type of quality. But, you know, 15 to 20 times EBITDA. So there's plenty of upside still to go in this one,
because
it's a 300 million market cap company. It looks like I don't think anybody would want to sell it as a shareholder to a certain extent, but private equity would just look at this and just think, wow, what a great company. Let's roll this into something else. And we can get even a bigger multiple going forward. So
yeah, I think so. But you know, again, they're becoming just sort of the go-to place for anyone who's looking to be part of a bigger thing. You know, this product, this platform that it's building, you know, again, it's all about data in the new oil, but it has international potential as well. Mm. You know, this is UK only at the moment, essentially. So, you know, wow. Could we have a software company that actually exports, takes over the world? And, you know, retail financial services has, as you say, secular tailwinds behind it.
Yeah, no, it's great business, no doubt about it. And it sort of defuncts the argument that there aren't good quality businesses on AIM, because that's one of them, very high quality. Okay, just
outrageously good.
Very last one. It's a beaten up stock, Van El, which basically does sort of specialist and ground piling and geotechnicals and stuff. We've had a big tick up in Keller of late, but that's mainly because of its US arm. This is more UK focused, but it should be a beneficiary, presumably, of housing getting back on its feet.
You would think so.
And also sort of like, if you know, with rail and other infrastructure.
Yeah, I picked this one out because, as you said, I mean, you know, sort of it's been beaten down by weakness in the housing market, but it's a very good company. You know, in terms of its sort of you know, technical abilities, it's a fantastic company. It's one of the go-to providers, just for whom market conditions have not gone its way. So you know, assuming there will be a recovery in the house building sector, which you would think, you know, we've got a general election on the way, you would expect, you know, some big promises around housing, and if Labour were to win, you would expect some serious support for the construction of social housing, and therefore, you know, there will be support for house building.
Have you spoken to the CEO at all?
I haven't. No. I would like to, but because, you know, this is a company that's been sort of, I would say, sort of, you know, hanging in there for a little while. Keeping things going, doing some judicious deal making. So it did buy, I think it was an asset from, did it buy a Galliford Try? But it gave it a sort of position in the southeast where it was weaker. And as you say, it's got exposure to some sort of infrastructure stuff as well. Mm. Energy and water in particular, you know, those things need significant investment. Rail, perhaps less so, but then it's looking overseas as well. So I think it's doing stuff in Canada.
Mm. I think a lot of its specialist piling is in rail because it was a big beneficiary of HS2, which is probably the reason why, because I've cancelled that northern leg.
Not
being helpful. I would say though, John, invite the CEO, Mark Cutler, to come on the show because I spoke to him before the pandemic and a long time ago. He's top notch, actually. He was back then. He was really on the ball and fired up. So I don't know where. I haven't spoken to him since, but you know, he definitely got a. I mean, obviously, he's been through a pandemic and ups and downs of the UK housing industry and all this sort of stuff. But
if it doesn't rain, it pours. You know, it's,
but he's now definitely battle hardened, along with his sort of like, you know, all the you know, he was passionate, very, very committed and passionate about the business and the industry.
Yeah, but I mean, that's what you want, you know.
Yes, it is.
You don't want to see companies going through tough times, but they do go through companies do go through tough times.
Yeah.
And you know, when they come out the other side of it in a position of reasonable strength, and you know, there's cash in this business as well, then you think they've done really well here. This is, you know, they've been through the wars and come out the other side, and as the market tailwinds improve, then they'll be fitter to exploit them.
Yeah, no, I like it. Okay, John, well, appreciate all those excellent comments, and thanks everyone for giving me your the questions. We've hopefully covered most of them there. So look forward again in touching base in about 2 months' time, John.
Yeah, I've come with some new companies on my watch list. Hopefully, we'd have bought a few the ones we talked about today.
Thanks very much, then, John.
Thanks, Paul.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.